Arthur falls in love in his first year at university. The fact that he's at university at all is a small miracle. It's the culmination of a plan he unconsciously set in motion the day he woke up in that hospital bed after Alvar's attack. The night in the warehouse had opened his eyes. He loved his father, but he had to get away from him. Uther's obsession with magic had consumed the father he once was, and a bitter, angry man left in his place was no substitute. Arthur had to leave before he ended up just like him. It wasn't that he disagreed with his father's stance on magic, exactly. He had no particular love for the magical community, and he believed they'd always be outsiders in society. They were genetically too different from normal people, their values and customs too strange. But beyond that, he couldn't muster up much hatred for them. Uther's vision of them as an all-powerful threat simply didn't ring true. Most magicals only had a limited array of spells at their disposal. Some barely had enough power to boil a kettle. The older Arthur got, the more his father's insistence that magicals would bring about the destruction of Britain seemed ridiculous. And the times were against him. The people had elected a pro-magical party. Laws and strictures against magic were being relaxed every day, and Arthur hadn't noticed society collapsing into the mire just yet. It had been a hard thing for him to acknowledge that his father might not be right. It went against everything he'd been brought up to believe, and it took nearly being killed to admit it. He can't forget what he saw and heard that night. He can't forget the fact that his father brought him to a place that almost cost him his life. The kind of anti-magical fervor that possessed his father wasn't moral anymore. It was mania. And Arthur was in danger every day he stayed around Uther and his seemingly unshakable obsession. He didn't want to leave home so he could actively work against his father. Arthur wasn't about to go out and start agitating for magical rights, and his father didn't have to worry about him bringing home a magical partner one day. But he wasn't going to work for their repression anymore, either. The best-case scenario was having absolutely nothing to do with a magical for as long as he lived. Let them get on in their own way, and he'd get on in his. He tells himself that this was a clear-sighted decision made after the events of the warehouse, based on logic and rationalism alone, and never lets himself remember the look in Alvar's eyes, wild and desperate and pitiful beyond belief. A key part of this plan is making sure he never ends up working at Arkstone in any capacity. When he receives his offer letter from UCL, he approaches his dad. His presentation has been 6 months in the making, and he doesn't falter. His hands are shaking as his father looks over the letter, brow creased. "Spanish and Latin American studies? What sort of nonsense is that?" "The kind of nonsense that will transport me to a country far away from you," Arthur thinks, but he humbly explains that his choice of degree could offer expansion opportunities for Arkstone in other regions. "You think you can handle the workload, do you?" his father asks doubtfully. "We both know you're no academic, son." "I met the great requirements to do the course," Arthur points out as respectfully as he can. He barely even feels the sting of Uther's implications about his intelligence, or lack thereof. His father's been plucking on that string for years. It's like background music now. "And you would start at Arkstone when you graduate?" Uther says slowly. "Yes," Arthur lies. He has no intention of ever coming back once he leaves this place, but he'll say what he needs to do for now. Uther fixes him with a beady gaze, and Arthur holds his breath. If his father says no now, then it's all over. He doesn't know what to do if that happens. He can move out on his own accord, but he'd have to get a job then, find a flat, start supporting himself. "You'll work at Arkstone in the holidays," Uther says finally. Arthur's knees nearly buckle with relief. "Yes, sir." "That includes Christmas and Easter, not just summer," Uther says sharply. "Yes, sir." It's a small price to pay, and once his degree's in his hand, he'll be able to find a job on his own, make money for himself. His father won't have any kind of hold over him to keep him at Arkstone. It's not coincidental that he's chosen a subject that primes him to live in another country. All being well, in 4 years' time he can leave England and his father behind for good. Uther doesn't accompany him on moving day, so he packs one large case and a rucksack and takes a bus to his new halls of residence. All around him are parents moving their teenagers in, but he feels only the slightest of pangs. He wants to do this on his own, to prove that he can. He ends up sharing with 5 other boys. They play loud music at all hours and drink a lot. Arthur's not used to so much noise, and he has to be careful with alcohol since he's barely touched a drop for the first 18 years of his life. They stop inviting him to hang out with them in the common room after a while, and one day he overhears them laughing about how weird he is. He tells himself not to care. He's lonely, but that's nothing new. He never had many friends at school either. Uther discouraged Arthur from wasting his time befriending other children. Time spent socializing was time not spent training, and Uther was always terrified that Arthur might end up making the acquaintance of a person with magic. He keeps his head down for a couple of months, finding it hard enough to muddle through his coursework and language labs without the added pressure of making friends. But after a while, he starts to covet the easy relationships forming around him. Most other first years seem to be foregoing the studying in favor of mixing and mingling. He's an outsider to the camaraderie and banter that goes on around him, and he suddenly wants in. He came here to study hard so he could find a job and get away from his father, but it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to pick up a few friends on the way. He's surrounded by people for the first time in his life, and it's getting harder to ignore how starved for company he is. So he decides to turn things around. It's this decision that leads him to standing outside a pub on a chilly night in November, smoking a cigarette someone gave him because he's never had one before, and he wanted to see how it tastes. Horrible, as it turns out, and he has to concentrate on not coughing and giving the game away. He doesn't want anything to make him stand out in a bad way. Arthur likes his course mates. He likes their easygoing attitudes and their casual disregard for the kind of rules he'd been brought up to think of as sacred. He knows they think he's a bit odd, slightly standoffish, and bad at casual conversation. But they had invited him out all the same, and he wants to prove himself tonight, to show that he's more than just a quiet guy in class who sits by himself and writes down every word the professor says. He's been practicing his small talk in the mirror the last few weeks, trying hard to smile in a way that looks natural, to rehearse a friendly greeting to extend to passers-by. He puts the theory into practice during his last lecture, picking Elian as a target for his muttered hello, as what he'd seen of the guy so far suggested he was the approachable type. Sure enough, Elian smiles and waves in return, and at the end of the lecture, Arthur doesn't rush out like he normally does. He lingers, packing up his things near where Elian and his friends are talking. "Swan and Hare for pre-drinks, yeah?" a tall bloke is saying. "Sounds good," Elian says, and then he looks over at Arthur, sidling past. "You fancy it, Arthur?"
"Pub night?"
Arthur says, clearing his throat. "Yeah, there's Swan down on Larch Road. Should be a laugh," Elian says easily.
"Cool,"
Arthur says, and softens his brevity with a smile. "Great, around 8, yeah?" Arthur actually arrives at 8, which he later learns is not done. No one ever shows up on time for nights out. But he waits it out, and when the rest arrive, he falls back on a tip he'd read in a fresher's guide the summer before. "Get a round in, and you'll make some friends for life." Sure enough, his courtsmates give a slight cheer as he passes round the pints, and there's a few friendly black slaps and nods. Arthur unclenches slightly. Perhaps he can do this after all. He doesn't contribute much to the conversation, happy to listen whilst at the same time slightly anxious to be thought of as boring. But he doesn't really know what to say. He hasn't spent all that much time around people his own age before. He's not familiar with all the references they make or a lot of the slang they use. Still, he thinks he must be acquitting himself well enough when Elian makes a point of inviting him outside with the others for a cigarette, offering him one from his own pack. He's concentrating so hard on not choking on the smoke that he doesn't notice the girl until she moves to stand beside him. She's wearing a pale pink dress and some soft fabric shoes, and he thinks for a second how badly she's dressed for the weather before she looks directly at him. Her eyes are very blue, and very big, and very... He can't quite breathe properly when he looks into them.
"Do you have a light?"
she says, and her voice is soft, musical. His suspicions that Elian is a stand-up bloke are confirmed as he feels him shove a lighter into his hand from behind.
"Here,"
Arthur says, and holds it out. She dips her head to catch the flame, cigarette dangling from her mouth. When it lights, she draws a slow deep breath and exhales a curl of smoke into the night air.
"Thanks,"
she says, and there's a pause. Arthur knows he should fill it, but he can't think of a single thing to say. Luckily, she speaks again.
"Haven't seen you here before."
"I'm a fresher,"
Arthur says, grateful to have an answer.
"Are you?"
"Second year. Chemistry. You?"
"Latin American studies."
"Oh, you speak Spanish? Portuguese?"
"Badly,"
he says, and for some reason they both laugh a little.
"But you're learning, right?"
she asks.
"Yes," Arthur says. "We get to go and study abroad in third year, so hopefully..."
"Where do you want to go?"
Arthur considers.
"Peru, I think. I like the sound of it."
"Can't say I know much about it."
"Me neither. I literally just like the sound of the name."
They laugh again, and it's stupid, but it feels natural and Arthur relaxes a little. He's just a normal boy in his first year at university, having a conversation with a pretty girl outside a pub. This is exactly the kind of thing he had hoped for when he left home in the first place.
"I'm Arthur," he says, suddenly confident.
"Sophia," the girl says, accepting his outstretched hand. "Nice to meet you. How do you say that in Spanish?"
Mucho gusto."
Sophia smiles.
"Mucho gusto, Arthur."
They talk for another 20 minutes, and she gives him her number when she leaves. Elian slaps him on the back and congratulates him on his flirting skills, but Arthur's not even sure what he did. Sophia carried most of the conversation, and she didn't seem to mind at all when he ran out of things to say. He wonders if she gave him her number out of pity, but when he texts her the next day, she replies almost instantly. They message back and forth for a while, and then she suggests they meet up for a coffee. Arthur's horribly nervous, changing his shirt 3 times before leaving the house, and he almost backs out at the last minute. He's convinced that in the harsh light of the day, without alcohol to cloud her senses, she won't want him anymore. He'll bore her, or he'll make things awkward, and she'll decide he isn't worth her time. But she doesn't. The conversation barely falters, and she asks to see him again at the end. Dinner this time, someplace quiet. They go for that dinner, and when he leaves her on her doorstep afterwards, she pulls him back and presses a feather-light kiss to his lips. He walks home in a daze, happiness swelling up inside him like a balloon. Sophia likes him. She actually likes him, and all he's done so far is be himself. It's a validation he didn't even know he needed until that moment, but now it's here, he wants to cry with relief. He is enough, just as himself. He's not falling short of anyone's expectations anymore. They see each other a lot after that. He's sad that he can't see her as much as he'd like to over Christmas. Her home is up north, and he has to spend almost all his time interning at Arkstone. But they talk every night, and she seems genuinely interested in hearing about the work he's doing. She does manage to come down for one weekend, and it's wonderful. They visit the Christmas market on the South Bank together, and he's entranced by how pink her cheeks look in the cold, how bright her eyes are as they wander past the stalls and food vans. They drink mulled wine in each stollen, and sit by the river to watch the boats go by. Then Sophia brings him back to the house she lives in during term time, and takes his clothes off piece by piece in her tiny little bedroom. She lies him down on the bed and climbs on top of him, and he's so overwhelmed that he can't make a sound all the way through it. He finishes too soon, he thinks, not that he has anything to compare it to, but she doesn't seem to mind. She lies down next to him afterwards, head resting on his chest.
She doesn't say a word about his scar, but when she starts stroking it softly, he gets an unexpected lump in his throat.
He starts, and his voice cracks embarrassingly. I really like you.
She drops a kiss on his nose.
I like you too, very much.
Arthur doesn't recognize the feeling flooding his chest, but he thinks it might be peace. Contentment after all this time, a sense that he's finally where he's supposed to be. She makes scrambled eggs in the morning and sets off the fire alarm when she burns the toast, and they laugh and laugh. When he puts her on a train that evening, he misses her the moment she's out of his sight. He doesn't mention her to Uther. He wants something that's just his own, and his father would only find a way to tarnish it somehow. He thinks his father suspects something is going on from the way he whistles and grins through all the drudge work he's assigned at Arkstone, but Uther has no proof, and he can hardly accuse his son of being suspiciously happy. When a term starts again, he and Sophia are officially in a relationship. Strangely, a lot of things about university become a lot easier. He doesn't find it half as difficult to talk to people anymore. He and Elian sit together in every class now, and he regularly goes to the pub with his course mates. He also joins the uni football team and gets on well with the other lads there. But he still likes hanging out with Sophia the best, even if he's just watching her write lab reports, or she's letting him practice his nouns and verbs with her. He's very happy, and he hopes she is too. Sometimes he wonders about her. There are moments when she looks at him, and there's a shadow in her eyes. But she doesn't mention her family much, except to say that she lives with her aunt, so he thinks there may be some pain there. He doesn't push her about it, though. He wants her to open up to him in her own time. And maybe he might be able to talk to her about his father, too, someday. Come Easter time, Sophia surprises him with the news that she's going to stay in London for the break. She says she'll study in the library while he's at work, and then they can meet up after.
And you can finally give me that tour of Arkstone you've been promising me.
I don't know why you want to go. You'll be bored out of your mind.
Hey, Sophia says, planting a kiss on the corner of his mouth. I want to see where you work. I'm interested in the things you do.
He feels a rush of warmth at her words.
Next week, he promises.
He picks a day when Uther's away at the Manchester base, and he brings her in around lunchtime. He gets her a visitor pass and has a story all prepared if anyone asks, but no one does. Gratifyingly, she really does seem to enjoy the tour, paying close attention to all the things Arthur shows her. It is an impressive building, Victorian architecture meeting clear glass offices and minimalist black furniture. He's still buoyed by this success when she makes another suggestion a week later.
You know what we should do? We should sneak in after dark someday. I bet that place looks awesome at night.
We couldn't,
he says, and Sophia gives him a mischievous look.
We could bring in some booze, maybe have a little picnic, then find a nice balcony somewhere and have some fun.
I don't know,
he says, but he's already caught up in the idea, flitting around in the dark, illicitly breaking in under his father's very nose. It's a scary idea, but it's exciting too. The third time Sophia brings it up, he cracks. They arrange to go that very night, and Arthur clandestinely modifies his pass in the computer lab to give him night access. He leaves at his usual time, and then he and Sophia drink in a bar around the corner, waiting until it's past 3 a.m., and even the most diligent are sure to have gone home. Then they creep back towards the building and slip in the main entrance. Arthur's not an idiot. He knows they'll probably get caught on CCTV and he'll be in for a bollocking tomorrow from Uther. But he doesn't care about that. He wants to live in the moment and damn the consequences. Oddly enough, the security guard seems to be asleep as they tiptoe by, which is a stroke of luck. He mentions it to Sophia, and she only smiles and offers him a sip from her hip flask. The alcohol is strong and bitter-tasting and drowns the other thoughts in his head out. They steal past the labs and take the stairs to the currently disused 8th floor, where there's a little abandoned office that Arthur occasionally escapes to for a minute of peace and quiet on busy days. It's the perfect place for the little picnic. Sophia was right. There is a certain thrill about being here after dark. So much so that Arthur starts to feel slightly heady with it, drunker than he felt only a few minutes ago. He nearly crashes into a door at one point, and Sophia pulls him along. They find the office at last, and Arthur collapses into a chair.
"I need to eat something," he says.
He's feeling very far gone all of a sudden. Sophia sets her rucksack down, but she doesn't take any food out of it.
"One more drink first," she says quietly.
"Seriously, Soph, I'm hammered. I need to..."
"Drink a toast to me, Arthur," she says, pressing the flask into his hand.
He grimaces and then relents.
"To Sophia, the most beautiful girl ever foolish enough to go out with me."
He takes a gulp, and it seems to hit him instantly.
"Wow, that thing packs a serious punch," he says, slurring slightly.
"It's supposed to," she says in that same quiet voice.
"Getting me drunk so you can have your wicked way with me?"
Arthur laughs, and it sounds louder than it normally does.
"Something like that," Sophia says.
"Better hope that security guard doesn't come in."
The room is spinning slightly now, and Arthur shuts his eyes.
"He won't. He'll be out for at least another hour with the spell I put on him."
"Yeah, wait, what?"
Arthur's eyes snap open. Sophia's looking at him very intently.
"I put a spell on him so that he wouldn't see us come in."
"What?"
Arthur says, mouth dry.
"You're not... You can't do spells."
"I can," she says, moving closer. "I have magic, Arthur."
"Stop joking around."
"I'm not."
Just...
He starts to rise.
"Don't get up."
Her warning's redundant. He can't get up. He can't really move at all.
I'm too drunk. I can't."
His limbs are like lead. They won't respond to his commands.
Sophia, I think I drank too much."
It's becoming harder to get the words out.
"It's not the drink. It's what I put in the drink," she says, holding up the flask.
Don't joke."
"I'm not joking," she says. "Not about the magic, and not about this."
Something in her tone gets through to him this time. Something about the way she's standing, the way her gaze is boring into him, her eyes darker than he's ever seen them before. He panics. He bucks up desperately, trying to kickstart some motion, but he barely moves an inch. His arms dangle uselessly, and his head's beginning to loll on his chest. It's getting harder to think clearly, and he has to fight to speak again.
Why?
"Shh, it's okay," she says, reaching into the backpack.
To Arthur's horror, she produces a roll of duct tape. He watches her bite off a piece and tries to marshal his useless body into action as she approaches. It does no good. She easily holds his head in place, sticking the tape over his mouth even as he slurringly begs her not to. Once he's gagged, she takes his right arm and duct tapes it to the armrest. She does the same with the left, and then she tapes his feet to the chair legs.
"The drug will wear off in a bit, and I need you nice and secure," is the only comment she makes.
Arthur loses track for a while after that. Thoughts slip away from him. There's no coherency or through line. Flashes of Sophia appear, memories of the time they've spent together, but the pictures are slanted, and they dissolve when he tries to look more closely. He's only dimly aware of the real thing in front of him, taking things out of her rucksack and arranging them on the desk, but the fog in his brain prevents him from processing what he can see. After some time, he doesn't know how long, he feels the urge to be sick, but the gag's in a way and he convulses, terrified that he's about to choke to death. Sophia turns around to see him spasming. She grabs the bin and walks over to rip the tape off. Instantly, he's retching, leaning forward to vomit into the bin until it feels like he's purged his whole stomach. Sophia strokes his hair through it, and that's somehow more horrifying than anything else. When he's finished, she gets a bottle of water from her rucksack and feeds some to him.
Poor baby. You're over the worst of it now. You should start to feel better.
She's right that his senses are slowly coming back to him.
Why are you doing this?
He gasps out the second she stops pouring water into his mouth. Sophia puts the gag back on before she replies.
I'm sorry about all of this, Arthur, genuinely. You won't believe it, but it's true. I never wanted it to come to this.
She grabs another chair and comes to sit in front of him.
I'll explain what I can before I have to go. I think you deserve that much. You see, I knew who you were before the night we met at the pub. I'd been following you since Freshers' Week.
Arthur shakes his head in disbelief.
Do you believe in destiny, Arthur? I never have, but when I heard Uther Pendragon's son was going to be attending my very own university, I knew it was fate. That you'd be the key to finally getting justice for my family.
Her gaze drills into him.
Your father killed my father, you know.
Arthur makes a faint sound of protest behind the gag.
Oh, not in the traditional sense. Nothing that could stand up in a court of law. Nothing that your father could ever be held accountable for. But it's true all the same. See, my dad was a scientist, and Arkstone doesn't believe that magicals should be scientists. They didn't like his research into how magic could be used for the benefit of its society. So they ran a smear campaign on him, discredited him in a series of journal articles, got him thrown out of the Royal Society, blacklisted from the university circuit. All his other job offers dried up too, and no one would publish his findings anymore.
There are tears in her eyes, but she brushes them away impatiently.
His work was his whole life, and your father took that away from him. So my dad went out to the garage last spring and hung himself.
Arthur's stomach drops. He wants to deny what he's hearing, but he knows it's all true. Arkstone do work to discredit magical academics. There's nothing about Sophia's story that rings false.
I'm sorry.
He tries to say, but the gag won't let the words through. Sophia seems to understand anyway.
You being sorry isn't enough. Do you know how many magicals they've already done this to? How many more they'll do it to? It has to end, Arthur. Someone has to take a stand.
She gets to her feet.
I'm not waiting around for things to change anymore. I'm making change happen. At 10 in the morning, when most of the Arkstone employees are at their desks, I'm setting this off, and then we'll see if anyone starts listening.
She gestures to the desk, and he's finally lucid enough to see what's on it. It's a bomb. Instantly, he starts thrashing around with what little movement has come back to him, trying to break free. It's no use. The duct tape is tied too tight, and he's still too weak. He shakes his head at Sophia desperately.
I know, she says quietly. I didn't want to do this. I don't want to hurt people. But this is the only way.
She looks over at the table.
My dad, it's like he's haunting me. I can't live in a world where people are allowed to treat us like this and walk away unpunished. It makes no sense to me.
Arthur's crying now, tears trickling down his face. Sophia turns to look at him, and her face softens.
I really do like you, you know. I wasn't faking all of it. I expected you to be some awful spoiled brat, spouting anti-magic nonsense all over the place. But you're better than that. If there was a way to let you go, I would.
She gently thumbs a tear away from his eye, then her face shudders down.
But there isn't. I'm sorry, Arthur.
She picks up her rucksack and walks back around to the table. She fiddles with one of the wires protruding from the bomb and then steps away.
It's armed now. The best part is, I don't need a detonator. I can set it off with a single spell from miles away.
She gives him a sad little smile. Magic and chemistry combined. I don't think my dad would have approved of me mixing them like this, but then... he's not here anymore, is he?
And with that, she's gone. Arthur goes into shock. His skin goes clammy and his pulse starts to skitter. He continues to cry helplessly for quite a while. Then he's too dehydrated to even produce any tears. He tries to lick at the tape over his mouth, dislodge it with moisture so he can cry for help, but it's stuck fast. He pulls at his bonds incessantly, but they don't give. They've been wrapped too tightly. He tries to move the chair and walk forward with it, but he only succeeds in tipping himself sideways onto the floor. He gives up then. He carries on tugging exhaustedly at the tape, but in his heart he knows it's all lost. Time is ticking away, and no one ever comes to this floor, let alone this office. They will never find him, and he'll never get out. He's going to die today, and what's worse is most of the staff will die with him. And it'll all be his fault for bringing Sophia here in the first place. He prays his father makes it out somehow. After all their differences, it suddenly seems like the most important thing in the world that his own stupidity doesn't cost his father his life. He feels a sudden rush of love for the man who raised him. He'd been so ungrateful, so churlish. All his secret plans to run away the second his degree was up and leave his father behind. How could he have been so cruel? Arthur lies there for a long time, listening to his heart thump in his ears, knowing that he only has a limited number of beats left. His bladder lets go, but he hardly notices. Will it hurt when it happens? Or this close to the bomb, will he simply be blown apart in an instant? The clock on the wall says his time is almost up. 25 minutes. He shuts his eyes and thinks about his father, about the mother he never knew. He hopes somehow he might finally meet her. Then, a knock at the door. Arthur, a voice says. I know you like to hide in here sometimes, but your dad's on the warpath. He's noticed you're not at your desk. Arthur tries to scream, but the gag blocks it all, and only a muffled whimper comes out. But thank God, the door is swinging open. It's Leon, a member of the legal team, still in mid-flow. I bought you a bit of time, but you need to... He stops short, finally seeing Arthur on the floor. There's only a moment of shock before he springs into action. Jesus Christ! He crouches down next to Arthur and begins pulling at the tape, but it barely shifts. Leon gets a look of grim determination on his face and grabs a letter opener from the desk. Hold still! He gets Arthur's arms free before he thinks to take the gag off, and Arthur sucks in a huge breath of air. There's a bomb, Leon. The table, there's a bomb. She came, and it's gonna go off at 10, and we need to get everyone out. We need to... He can't form any more words, but he's said enough. Leon stood to look at the table, and all the blood drains out of his face. Without a word, he tosses the letter opener to Arthur and races from the room and towards the lift. Arthur's just managed to free himself fully when his father strides in. Are you all right? He barks. Are you hurt? No, Arthur says, although he can't quite get to his feet. He shuffles back instead, making way for a man called Aradian that he recognizes from the lab. A few more people spill into the room, and Aradian curls his lip. Everybody stand back. I need space. They do as he says, until it's just Arthur, Uther, Leon, and Aradian left inside, and the door slams shut. Aradian approaches the table and starts to inspect the device. 4 whole minutes tick by. Arthur counts them. There's now 12 minutes left until the bomb detonates, assuming Sophia doesn't try and set it off early. After all the horror of the last few hours, the end is anticlimactic. Without so much as a word of warning, Aradian reaches into the body of the device and pulls a wire free, then another. Clear, he says briefly. Arthur can't quite believe it. It's disarmed, he asks weakly. It was well made, but in no way temper-proof, Aradian says dismissively. They clearly weren't expecting anyone to get to it in time, whoever they are. Uther turns to look at Arthur on the floor. Who set that bomb, son?
His tone is more gentle than Arthur's heard it in a long time. He clearly thinks his son has been the victim of some terrible crime, forced to help a villain gain entrance to Arkstone and then left to die here. For a moment, Arthur wants to lie, to go along with the pretense that he'd been coerced against his will, that he's an innocent bystander in this. But it's futile. There's CCTV footage of them coming in. Too many people know they were dating. He can't pretend. So he tells the truth instead. Everything from the day he met Sophia to the moment she walked out of Arkstone just hours before. He can see his father's face getting darker and darker the more he speaks, and he ends up mumbling his story to the floor, not daring to meet anyone's eye. When he finishes, there's a long silence. Aredian, Leon, please go and wait in my office for me, Uther says in a tone devoid of emotion. Tell the people outside that the crisis is averted and they should return to their desks for the time being. Arthur can't help but glance up as the two men leave. Aredian's look is full of cold disgust for Arthur, but Leon's is pitying. He cannot tell which is worse. The door clicks shut behind them.